This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today. Joining us also today is Joe Resendiz. He is an automotive research analyst and study author for Value Penguin, because we're going to talk about DUIs. We're coming up on a holiday. You know, the Memorial Day weekend is coming up next weekend, and that's a time when people get in their cars after maybe having done something else that they shouldn't have before getting behind the wheel. And Joe has been researching this for Value Penguin. Joe, thanks for joining us.
It's nice to be here.
Give us a little background here first. What is Value Penguin? It's an online service.
That's correct. So Value Penguin is a consumer research finance firm. So we like to do studies where we know that people might be impacted in terms of their finances, whether that's, you know, insurance costs or savings or anything among, you know, the personal lines realm.
What is its business model? How does it sustain itself with this service?
Well, we have partnerships with other companies that allow us to, you know, to take part in kind of these studies that help consumers make decisions that best impact their finances, their personal finances.
So how does Value Penguin decide what issues to study?
Yeah, so it's really what's topical at the time. So for this study in particular, you know, we knew that drunk driving was a problem in America, and we wanted to study whether DUI fatalities varied from state to state.
So how did you conduct the research?
Yeah, so to conduct the research, we examined the total number of motor vehicle fatalities stemming from alcohol-impaired driving as reported by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And the data we observed, being impaired means having a BAC of 0.08 or higher, which is the legal limit. We compared these figures to the population of each state, which in effect normalizes our data and makes it comparable from state to state. So while North Dakota, for example, might not have the same population as Texas, by doing this, we're normalizing it and we're able to compare across states.
Well, the Value Penguin headline for this particular study was the top 10 states where you're most likely to be in a fatal DUI. Number one is Montana with more than 8 DUI deaths per 100,000 residents. Number two is North Dakota with 6.62 DUI deaths per 100,000 residents. So that's not good news for us.
You know, it's certainly not. And it's much worse than its neighbor just south in South Dakota, which ranks as the seventh deadliest state. In North Dakota specifically, approximately 44% of all car wreck fatalities involved at least one driver who was over the legal limit. And again, that's a BAC of 0.08 or higher. But what I found even more shocking was that nearly one in five adult arrests are for DUIs within North Dakota.
And Minnesota ranks 48th in comparison, and New York is the best in the country, just a little bit better actually, though, than Minnesota, 1.43 deaths per 100,000 involved in DUI fatalities. So interesting range there. Now, Value Penguin ranks car insurance. What effect does a DUI have on an offender's insurance premium? I assume it knocks it up quite a bit.
Exactly. So one of the factors that insurance companies look at to determine auto insurance rates is your record for driving. And if you have a DUI on record, then your auto insurance rates shoot up. And that's regardless of whether you're a young or a senior driver. You can expect your rates to increase massively.
Well, what effect does a high rate of DUI fatalities have on auto insurance rates for others in the state that has a record like North Dakota's? Does it affect the rest of us too?
Right, yeah. So I can't say to how, you know, I can't speak to how auto insurance companies evaluate regions as a whole, but I will say that it is something to think about, and it is an interesting point to be brought up. Ultimately, though, I think that determination is made by the auto insurance companies themselves and their underwriting departments.
Well, you are six or seven times more likely to die in a DUI accident in Montana than you are in New York.
Mm-hmm.
What are some states doing right?
Yeah, so I would say it's hard to pinpoint one single factor, but our study didn't evaluate the reasons behind the number of fatal DUIs. And there are proponents, though, that say that stricter alcohol laws would reduce the figures, and that certainly may be valid, but I think it's important to note that there could be other factors at play. Specifically in North Dakota, for instance, which is one of the deadliest regions for DUIs, there's also a lot of harsh winter weather conditions, and it could be the case that snow and ice on the road plays a factor in DUI-related deaths. There's also various separate studies by other organizations that list these states as the booziest, which in other words means that these states consume the most alcohol. So while we could look at laws, I think it's important to note that there are other factors that may also be impacting these high DUI fatality rates.
When you were looking at this from a national perspective, how are we doing? Are DUIs diminishing over the years or remaining constant, or is there any change that way?
So over the past, I would say, decade, there's been a decrease in the number of DUI fatalities. But as recently as 2014, we've started seeing an upward trend. So although we were doing well as a country, as a whole, that trend has somewhat shifted in recent years.
Hmm. Any theories as to why?
You know, like I mentioned, there's a lot of factors at play. And ultimately, I think it would require another study, and it might be worthy of it, given that it's such a widespread problem.
Now, holidays like the upcoming Memorial Day weekend record more DUIs than other times of the year. So this is obviously a period in which we should be a little more vigilant, I take it.
Yep. So some, you know, police departments around this time of the year like to set up more sobriety checkpoints. And, you know, you could argue that that's a good thing. Some states, though, actually don't allow sobriety checkpoints, which is surprising given that, you know, DUI fatalities are such a big problem.
Well, you mentioned that this means higher insurance rates for those people who are guilty of a DUI infraction. You can also lose your license. You can be fined. You can go to jail in some cases as well. So there are some, you know, pretty severe penalties for crossing this line.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, to speak to North Dakota specifically, a first-time offense classifies as a Class B misdemeanor. There's also a $500 fine along with your license suspended for 91 days, and that's only if your BAC is below 0.16. If your BAC is any greater than that, you'll face up to 2 days in jail and even a higher fine.
Hmm. Autonomous vehicles sound kind of appealing when, you know, compared with this kind of issue or even speeding. Are insurance companies kind of interested in this development, do you think?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, in terms of autonomous vehicles, we're definitely starting to see a shift in how insurance companies think about the use of technology. And one of the ways that I would note that that's prevalent is through the use of telematic technology. So today, if you have a certain insurance company, you can download a mobile app and have your driving behaviors tracked through your mobile phone. And then your auto insurance company will either increase or decrease your rates based on your driving behavior. So that's one of the cool shifts that we're seeing in the insurance field that's being driven from technology.
The online site is Value Penguin. You can find it at valuepenguin.com. And, Joe, when you go up there, you do offer, you know, these various studies and services, but there are also insurance insurance plans being sold up there too, or compared. How do you do that?
Yeah, so we do a lot of things. So we actually look at the policies and what they offer, and we like to evaluate them against themselves because ultimately you need auto insurance if you have a car, in most states at least. So it's a decision that you're forced to make, and we find that if we just provide as much data as possible, that it helps consumers to be able to pick which of these, you know, auto insurance companies works better for them.
Do you think your methodology is different or similar to something like Consumer Reports, for example?
Yeah, I would say that we do a very thorough job in explaining, you know, not just what discounts are available, but what each discount means to specific drivers. So if you are a young driver, we offer reviews that, you know, for some insurance companies that might work well for you versus if you're a senior driver or any other type of driver profile.
So is this an eye-opener for somebody like you when you are comparing various insurance plans? You might see one that in your eyes looks a whole lot better than the other. Is that possible?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, insurance companies vary greatly from one policy to another. So I think it's important to shop around and compare rates. That's often one of the top recommendations that we have, is to shop around and compare rates, because ultimately that's how you're going to get the lowest rates and sometimes even better coverage.
And everybody likes to think they're getting a deal. So I suspect these online services like Value Penguin, your reputation is enhanced by objectivity, I take it.
Correct. Yep.
So how do you ensure that?
Yeah, so we have strong integrity in that, you know, we evaluate each product as the research analyst deems fit. So whoever, you know, writes up a review has journalistic control, and their opinion is aired on our website.
On your website, you say, we curate for value. We distill sprawling marketplaces for insurance, credit cards, bank accounts. These are all services that everybody needs, and everybody is clearly looking for the best possible, you know, direction. Again, Value Penguin suggests that you're aware of that. So how long has Value Penguin been around?
So we've been around for a little over 4 years now. You know, we've been around for a while, and we've grown in the services that we provide consumers and the information that we provide for consumers. Ultimately, though, like I said, the mission is to create this website that not just offers information about insurance, but about all aspects of personal finance.
Well, what are you working on now? You finished your DOI study.
So, you know, now that you mentioned the self-driving car aspect, I might take a look at that.
Okay. Well, Joe Resendez is an automotive research analyst and the study author for Value Penguin's report on DUI in the United States. And just to remind people, the top 10 states where you're most likely to be in a fatal DUI have North Dakota as number 2. So, Joe, thanks for spending some time with us today.
No problem. It was great to be here.
More Main Street in a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
I showed up for work the first day without any knives. I didn't know you were supposed to bring your own knives, so I borrowed one from the chef. And I was also wearing Nike running pants that were a little bit too tight underneath my apron, so I got a nickname on my first day. Chrissy Pants.
Join us next time for stories about the dangers, the pleasures, and the sometimes harsh realities of food. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Jennifer Walcott Goldstein is a lifelong educator, working as a teacher, teacher coach, and administrator. She's passionate about finding ways to keep teachers engaged and at the top of their game. She joined the Cutting Ed podcast host Tom Gerhardt to talk about School Retool, a fellowship that takes place over 3 to 4 months.
How did School Retool develop a relationship with North Dakota?
A close collaborator of School Retools is Ted Dentersmith, who has been, you know, very active in elevating the work in North Dakota and helping to, you know, push some of that work forward. And so, in some conversations with Ted, he was very adamant that from all the work that he'd seen of what amazing educators in North Dakota are doing, that School Retool could be a great fit for North Dakota. So through him, got a chance to participate in the Governor's Summit on Innovative Education last year in 2017, sharing a little bit about the program along with a few other colleagues at that opportunity. And then had a chance to get connected to the DPI and form a cohort of 20 leaders from around the state of North Dakota that participated in the first School Retool Fellowship in North Dakota in the fall of 2017.
So tell us what School Retool is doing on the ground here in North Dakota with those 20 cohorts, the schools that you're in.
Yeah, definitely. So we had the opportunity to work closely with those 20 leaders from around the state in that four-day workshop that I was describing this fall. So in about from mid-September 2017 through late November 2017, you know, holding workshops, coaching leaders, seeing them try out their hacks, shadow a student for a day in their school, and then start to make some of those changes that were aligned to the aspirations they had for their school and where they wanted to take the work in their school, and giving them some tools and resources to get started a little bit faster and a little bit maybe more scrappy way that doesn't involve a ton of additional resources, which is what School Retool is all about.
What feedback have you heard so far from principals and teachers in North Dakota, or even across the country for that matter, since the program started?
I'll just share a couple of quotes from some of the folks in North Dakota from this fall. So one person shared at the end of this cohort, they said, since participating in School Retool, as an administrator, I feel more passionate and again can find true purpose in my job. You know, another quote that I'll share from the cohort that was there is someone shared that School Retool has made me realize leaders need to demonstrate change. Change needs to start small. Starting too big too soon is not a recipe for success. Don't follow the go big or go home philosophy, which is something that we hear a lot, not just in schools, but in our culture. You know, if it's not big, then it's not meaningful. And our tagline at School Retool is big change starts small. And I think that that quote really embodies what we've seen in the cohort in North Dakota, but also what we've seen in other regions around the country, that taking something that's big that maybe could take years to get started, but really breaking it down in that bite-sized experiment of a hack that you could do tomorrow with the resources around you, not taking more than an hour of your time, can give leaders the leverage that they sometimes need to get started on change, and also can be a way to get others, you know, coming alongside you with that work too, because it allows the change to not seem as top down, but really generative and action based in a way that I think, you know, leaders are then able to enlist others in a really meaningful way in that work.
So. Let's talk about a hack, a small change here in North Dakota. When we spoke earlier this year, you mentioned a teacher from Watford City, Carrie Stansfield. Can you tell us a little bit about what she's doing just to help people visualize maybe one of these small changes that lead to big things?
So Carrie was seeking for her students to work collaboratively in order to maximize learning, share their understanding, and add value to their work. And so she wanted to start to hack her way toward a practice of learning galleries, which is you know, something that we've seen in a lot of schools that are getting to deeper learning outcomes around the country. You know, really using public displays of student work for students to not only think that makes their work more authentic, but also collaborate with others in making that, and as a way of sharing the work that and knowledge that they've built. And so one thing that she did to be able to do that is she got in touch with a couple of local organizations, such as a coffee shop, a firehouse in her local town, and had her students take some of their work and display it in those local areas. So not only was she, you know, it wasn't making new student work, but like using current student work, but also then putting it in a public place where their community could engage and ask questions of those students in a really powerful way. And so that gave her a lot of insights about, you know, what's the type of work students want to display. She saw students and teachers cheerleading for each other during these exhibitions. So really seeing, you know, powerful engagement in the work and positivity toward the work of school in a way that I think was pretty unique for what she had seen in the past. And with that small hack, you know, of getting a few things out, you know, now has learned a lot about those learning galleries, about what makes those meaningful, and then has plans to continue to expand those to a few other grade levels in her school, and also having an opportunity for her teachers to show their work a little bit more explicitly to students along the way.
Sounds like the teachers have a lot of flexibility to adapt to their own students and their own classrooms with these hacks.
Definitely, yes. For the leaders that are in School Retool, we start the work with a framework that, you know, has them set an aspiration, identify behaviors, identify a practice that's seen around deeper learning schools that they want to start to hack toward, and then develop their own hacks. But it's very important that while we provide the framework, that what that work is what matters to them most. You know, we don't have a recipe or a silver bullet for this. You know, I don't think anybody does. And we have the tools of design and design thinking, which is where a lot of the, not only the framework that we use, but then also some of the mindsets of taking a bias to action, failing forward, starting small, that we work with leaders to cultivate and develop through the fellowship, you know, come from. And we think that it's most important that this work is grounded in what matters most for leaders, for their students and their school and their community as they move forward on a change journey that they lead and enlist others in.
On the topic of students and preparing them for success for life in the real world down the road, I wanted you to talk a little bit more about the shadow a student challenge, because it seems to me that we haven't been able to see through this podcast enough yet from a student's perspective. So I'm curious about that program.
You know, the time that we run a big campaign around Shadow a Student. So if you haven't yet checked it out, it's shadowastudent.org and can get a ton of resources there. And what it is a call to action for educators really around the world to take a day of empathy for their students. to take a day to, you know, to turn off their walkie-talkie or their cell phone, or, you know, put on, you know, the clothes that their students wear, meet them at the bus stop, and really try to experience life through the lens of a student. And we found that, you know, this is a practice that, you know, shadowing a student is not a new practice. You know, it's been around as a practice for educators to try to engage in for a long time. And as shadowing is a practice of empathy that we use a lot in the world of design thinking to better understand users in different situations. And the challenge was spurred a couple of years ago, you know, to try to amplify that practice and give leaders a community of other educators around the country that are doing that practice, as well as a set of tools and resources about how to easily get started. You know, we've heard from a lot of educators like, oh yeah, I've heard about shadowing a student, or I've always thought about doing that, but I don't know how to get started. So the website is not only a place to, you know, be inspired by other people, but also very practically a place for tools and resources on how do you get started and how do you think about taking notes and how do you, you know, let students or teachers know what you're going to be doing. So we hope through this work that it can break down some of those barriers to entry to allow more folks to take that time and day for that practice, which we've seen through the work of leaders participating in the Shadow a Student Challenge, as well as leaders in School Retool that have participated in this, to be a very transformative experience. You know, because you have the opportunity to not just like kind of think about what school might be like for a student, but to really experience it. And for the educators that take the day to do it, I think it can be both a very positive experience to reaffirm some of the really great things that are definitely happening in every school around this country, but also sometimes a little humbling and a little sobering, you know, to see and witness and really experience firsthand some of the practices and things that are happening on a day-to-day basis for students.
Some final thoughts. What does success look like for School Retool 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, just a few years into the program? But yeah, it sounds like the impacts have been substantial so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think that we're always incredibly humbled and incredibly amazed. And every cohort that we run with the educators that we get a chance to work with and a chance to engage with, and they teach us so much about what can be possible as we continue this work. You know, I think as we think about success, you know, we really are thinking about, you know, how are we continuing to support and sustain leaders and then bringing some of their teams and other community members along in that mindset for change that puts them in a position to take actions that are student-centered, to continue to really understand the student experience, and then to use some of those practices of quick action, experimentation, and work to really affect change over time. You know, so we've seen schools, you know, do everything from, you know, totally realign their career pathways program so that they get rid of tracking in their school, you know, and really focus on student career interest, you know, to growing out full advisory programs in schools that were, you know, really weren't on track to have one of those before School Retool. And I think that for us, it's less about the practice, you know, because there's many ways to get toward deeper learning, and each of those is going to be unique and different for each school. You know, but ultimately, we're seeking, you know, to continue to support educators, you know, leaders and their teams in sustaining that mindset shift for change that can allow them to continue to create transformative experiences for, you know, on students' lives and learnings over time.
Jennifer Walcott Goldstein speaking with Tom Gerhart, host of the Cutting Ed podcast. The Cutting Ed podcast involves North Dakota United, Prairie Public, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and philanthropist Ted Dintersmith. Coming up on Main Street, a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Ezern, a fundraising collaboration between Prairie Public and Barnes & Noble to give free books to kids, and our What's Happening list of things to do this weekend. First, the news with Todd.
Thank you, Doug. Police in Grand Forks found one man dead and one woman wounded during a welfare check today in South Grand Forks. Police were dispatched to the scene around 11:30 this morning on a welfare check with possible injuries. They say the reporting party was not at the scene. Police Lieutenant Brett Johnson.
And when they got here, they discovered one deceased male and a female with a gunshot injury. Appears to be non-life-threatening. Both victims had gunshot wounds.
Johnson says there was a relationship between the people but gave no details. Police say the injured woman was taken to All True Hospital. Authorities say there's no indication of an ongoing threat to the general public and charges are unlikely. The names of those involved have not been released. Minnesota DFL Governor Mark Dayton has vetoed the GOP income tax bill.
This bill gives cake to the rich and big corporations and crumbs to people who need it.
Dayton says the tax measure skews tax reductions to higher-income Minnesotans as well as corporations. He says in exchange for a tax bill, he wanted emergency aid to Minnesota schools, which he says Republicans are refusing to provide. Republican House Speaker Kurt Dowd says he's disappointed. Dowd says the bill would have provided tax cuts to Minnesotans and simplified the income tax to reflect federal tax changes. He says without it, next year's tax filing season will be trouble.
If the governor doesn't sign a tax bill this year, it will take a phone book for Minnesotans to file their taxes next year. And I have very low confidence that our revenue department will be able to actually put together the system and the forms necessary for people to file.
Dowd says he hopes to meet with the governor soon to try to work out an agreement before the legislature adjourns. And an Iowa Republican congressman looking to expand who's eligible for certain conservation programs under the next farm bill. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer has an update.
The House is looking at the massive bill, which funds agriculture and nutrition programs for 5 years. Already, the debate has been contentious, mainly over changes to nutrition assistance, which accounts for most farm bill dollars. Conservation programs also face significant changes. Iowa Republican Steve King says his amendment, passed by a voice vote, would let drainage districts compete for federal conservation dollars. But Ricardo Salvador of the Union of Concerned Scientists says that's an example of how agribusinesses respond when they see openings for local and state governments to potentially create different policies.
They essentially say, let's devise a rule that we can live with, but that actually preempts what individual states are doing. Let's not fight this battle 50 times. Let's go for some federal legislation. And then that sets the bar.
The Senate has yet to introduce its version of the Farm Bill. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern teaches history at NDSU and writes about it, too. He's a Main Street regular as the voice behind his Plainsfolk essays. Today's piece is titled Rhubarb Days.
You can talk about your daffodils and your cherry blossoms, but this is the springtime emergence that counts, rhubarb. As the bulbs grow rank into stalks and leaves, there are two things I crave. I'll tell you about one of them now and the other in the end. First, rhubarb crisp. I like the urgency of it. No time for rolling pie crust. We need to get this juicy green stuff into the oven, out of it, and onto a plate pronto. Because rhubarb is not about patience. It is about immediate need. Throughout the central and northern plains, rhubarb, pie plant, as many called it, served as a fruit substitute for pioneers. About this time, in 1880, the Bismarck Tribune reported, Mrs. Thomas Riley has rhubarb, or pie plant, in her garden that a single stalk will make an ordinary pie, and it is not a mammoth variety either. Mammoth Red, by the way, remains today a popular variety. That same year of 1880, Elder Inman, who sold agricultural implements and farm supplies and just about anything else you might need in Jamestown, was a veritable Johnny Appleseed of rhubarb in Dakota Territory. He advertised repeatedly, "Call on Elder Inman for all kinds of garden seed, horseradish, and rhubarb plants now on hand." I quote these typical newspaper notices just to show that rhubarb was a horticultural staple of the prairie frontier. There are two reasons for the pervasiveness of rhubarb in pioneer communities on the plains. The first reason was impatience. It took at least a few years before fruit trees would bear fruit. But rhubarb likely would begin supplying you with pie makings in 2 years. The second reason was environmental. The continental extremities of climate on the plains found many traditional fruit varieties wanting in hardiness. This necessitated a period of experimentation, during which rhubarb proved its faithfulness. In the 19th century, rhubarb was considered a tonic, like other spring greens, to be consumed early in the season to get the system moving again. The story was told. of the Duchess of Buccleuch, who offered a dish of rhubarb, a favorite of hers, to one of her tenants, to which offer he replied, "I'm muckle obleeged to your grace, but I dinna need it." The settlement period on the plains, too, was a time of the great newspaper debate as to the processing of rhubarb stalks for the table. Evidently, it was common to peel the stalks, cutting away the fibrous elements. Health-conscious Victorians, however, advocated using the whole stalk, fibers and all. Most preparation for pies, cobblers, preserves was simple. The editor of the Hope Pioneer bragged in 1898 that while his wife was away visiting back east, he had turned out a rhubarb pie that has never been equaled. This after first sneaking into the garden under cover of darkness, dispatching the rhubarb with a club, and then hanging it overnight on the woolshed corner until all the animal heat is out of it, he said. That other delicacy of which I spoke at the outset, however, is an invention of my own household, the Lena Margarita. Rhubarb syrup and tequila with ice in a blender, the slush then poured into a chilled glass rimmed with lime salt. Be careful, it goes down easy. This essay cannot close without a shout to the ladies of Litchfield, North Dakota, who gave us that classic treatise in the culinary culture of the Northern Plains, Ritzy Rhubarb Secrets. This work should be a welcome wagon gift for all newcomers to North Dakota, so they will know what we are about.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, a collaboration between Prairie Public and Barnes & Noble to raise money to hand out free children's books.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Maria and Eric Overn, celebrating their 21st wedding anniversary today.
Giving to Prairie Public is as simple as sending a text. Just text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and set up the monthly deduction of your choice. $5, $10, $15, $20 a month? It's as simple as that. Here's the deal. You give what you can, and Prairie Public delivers reliable, fact-based journalism and outstanding top-shelf programs without commercial interruption or influence. Simple. So reach for your smartphone and text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and simply support Prairie Public today. And thanks.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Deanne Hopfa. She's the Business Development Manager for Barnes & Noble here in Fargo, and Marie Offit, the Communications Manager for Prairie Public, because, Marie, this is sort of a joint effort that we're going to talk about today. Free books for kids, right?
Free books for kids, yes. We're partnering with Barnes & Noble. They're hosting a book fair for us so that we can accumulate books to give away to children at our Share a Story events. The next event is on Saturday, June 9th at Roe Farm in Fargo. But Prairie Public does host Share a Story events across the state.
All right. And so this opportunity for the free books for children is actually in front of the Share a Story event.
Yes.
It starts May 19th, and there's an online presence as well, too. Deanne, explain how this is going to work.
So the way Barnes & Noble book fairs work is local schools and nonprofit organizations that support literacy among our children can set up a book fair with us at the store. They pick a certain day. In this case, it is Saturday, May 19th, this coming Saturday. And you invite all of your supporters to come into the store and shop in support of your what you're raising money for. So it's a fundraiser. And what you do is you invite your people in to come. Any purchase, even a simple cup of coffee from our cafe, you tell your cashier, hey, I'm with the book fair, and then a portion of your sale will be contributed back to Share a Story.
And Barnes & Noble has stores in Fargo, Bismarck, and Minot, so all three of these stores across the state will be involved in this book fair effort to raise money for Share a Story on Saturday, June 9th.
Exactly.
So there's another option here as well,
yes.
Isn't there?
If you can't come into the store, you can shop online May 19th through the 24th and use a special promo code 123-18994. And if you don't have a pen to write that down, you can go to prairiepublic.org and we have that promo code listed there also.
And we'll put it on our Main Street and Facebook page as well.
Okay,
so
good.
It's a number you need to use online. Let's talk about how this relationship got going. You know, Barnes & Noble, Prairie Public, raising money to give free books to kids.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Prairie Public has partnered with United Way of Cass Clay and Fargo Parks to host the Share a Story event here in Fargo for 15 years now. And the event is all free. And like I said, that event is on June 9th at Rowe Farm from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's all free. Daniel Tiger will be there. Uh-huh. I know kids really love Daniel Tiger. We'll have the Poco Fuego Steel Drum Band and Buffalo River Dancers and Fargo Firefighters Knockdown House and the Red River Zoo and face painting and all sorts of fun. Lunch and snacks are provided, free, of course, and every child gets to take home a free book. Well, how do we pay for all those books? We partner with Barnes & Noble, and they help us raise the money to buy those books that we can give away to children. The whole point is family literacy. And because Barnes & Noble and Prairie Public have similar missions, it just seems like a natural partnership.
It's useful, I assume, Deanne, that to encourage kids to read books if you're selling books.
Absolutely. These are our future customers.
And, of course, the Share a Story event June 9th in Fargo at Rowe Farm mm-hmm. is preceded again by this event Saturday, May 19th in those Barnes & Nobles in Fargo, Bismarck, and Minot. And there will be a story time there as well, correct?
Yes. And in Fargo, Prairie Public's own radio director, Bill Thomas. You hear him on the radio all the time here.
I see him every day.
He's going to be the storyteller. That starts at 11 o'clock this Saturday at the Barnes & Noble in Fargo. And he's going to read, and he's also going to do some musical storytelling. So if you've never heard Bill Thomas perform, you might want to come because he's very talented and very entertaining.
Yes, and I hope his ears are burning right now. Let's talk a bit about this education mission of our outfit here, Prairie Public. Mm-hmm. We've got a division here at Prairie Public that's devoted to that. And Deanne, you used to work in that area.
I did.
And so now you're working sort of in that area, if you will, for Barnes & Noble. But let's talk about how this works at in our facility.
I actually work in the communications department, and we do a certain amount of outreach. We like to get out into the community and talk about what Prairie Public offers to our communities. We go to, the Midwest Kid Fest, and we have these Share a Story events all across the state, and we participate in parades, things like that. But we also have an education department that is specifically devoted to connecting with child care providers, caregivers, and teachers. They offer a lot of professional development. In fact, I think they're at a professional development conference today, and they show teachers and caregivers how to use PBS resources in the classroom, how to use Sesame Street, for instance. You know, you watch it on television, but then you turn off the television and you can use the resources that are offered online to everybody, really, to drive home those lessons. We call it view, learn, and do. You view it, you learn something, and then you do something.
Well, our television service offers several programming streams now that we're in the digital 21st century, I mm-hmm. guess. But the primary one during the daytime is actually devoted to kids.
Yes, yes, all children's programs. And then our fourth multicast channel is PBS Kids programs 24 hours a day. And a lot of parents have told us they appreciate that. They appreciate being able to sit down at the 7 o'clock hour after dinner and watch PBS Kids with their children.
Deanne, I've got a 4-year-old grandson, just about 4 at any rate, and he loves books. What is it about kids and books, and how does Barnes & Noble position itself, I guess, to provide that kind of literary service to that age group?
Well, in addition to partnering with organizations such as Prairie Public and the Share a Story mission, we also, every Saturday at 11 a.m., every Barnes & Noble in the nation hosts a story time.
So story time with Bill Thomas is not just some strange coincidence.
Correct. Every Saturday we do have the story times where it's a free and open to the public event where you can bring your kiddos in and we read a fun story or two, and then we have some sort of activity again to sort of reinforce that learning and the joy of reading. And in the Fargo store, we also have Wednesday morning story time. So each store will have their own schedules. But every store, every Barnes & Noble in the country at 11 a.m. on Saturdays will have a story time.
Well, take in a story this Saturday, please, and take advantage of the free books for children offered by Barnes & Noble by shopping at Barnes & Noble in Bismarck, Fargo, or Minot for those books for kids. A portion of your sale will be donated to the Prairie Public Share a Story events across the state. And, of course, we've been talking about the one coming up June 9th in Fargo. If you want to go online, you can do that from May 19th through the 24th and use a promo code, and it will be available online. And you can find it right at our prairiepublic.org website homepage as well. Thank you very much for being with us. Deanne Hofflog with Business Development Management at Barnes & Noble, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Marie Offit, Communications Manager at Prairie Public. A pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Doug.
What's happening is next.
This week on Away with Words, what better way to spend an evening than arguing with your friends about language?
It became a debate one night at a bar in downtown San Diego amongst my friends. Apparently we have nothing better to talk about than the proper use of idiomatic expressions.
It goes all the way back at least to Thomas Jefferson. He used it that way.
Well, I don't know what to think now.
Join us
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Oh, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? What's going on? Oh, what's going on?
Yes, that's the musical question we ask every Thursday. Ashley Thornburg and I look at our list of what's happening. You know, there's a weekend looming.
And here's a fun event for that weekend, this Sunday the 20th in Rugby at the Prairie Village Museum. It is the Prairie Village kickoff party to celebrate the opening of the 2018 season. This kickoff event is from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Again, this is Sunday the 20th. The museum will have an afternoon barbecue, a concert, and it's also the grand opening of the new World War I exhibit that is focusing on central North Dakota from plowboys to doughboys. And that exhibit, by the way, is open for the entire 2018 season at the Prairie Village Museum. Again, the kickoff party is from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., and it's free.
A public planetarium show features a double feature Saturday in Valley City at the Rhodes Science Center at Valley City State. Navigating with Lewis and Clark, how did they know where they were when they were in the middle of nowhere? That's the question. This program explains how Lewis and Clark used astronomy to navigate and map the Louisiana Purchase to remarkable accuracy. And then the Norse sky. What did ancient Scandinavians see when they looked to the high northern skies over 1,000 years ago? Norse gods explain some of the sky stories known to the Vikings. It starts at 1 o'clock at the Rhodes Science Center at Valley City State, Saturday afternoon in Valley City, and it's free.
Antiques Bone Show, Saturday the 19th in Dickinson at the Dickinson Museum. Do you have some historical items? Maybe you have some fossils or some interesting looking rocks. Bring those items to Pioneer Machinery Hall at the Dickinson Museum, and you get to visit with a local professional who can tell you if what you have is something, or maybe it's just something you found that kind of looks cool. Either way, you're sure to have a good time at Antiques Bone Show, Saturday the 19th in Dickinson at the museum, at the Dickinson Museum Center. 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., the appraisal fee, $5 per item, and limit 4 items.
Silver Follies, Murder and Mayhem. It's every year, the Silver Follies at the stage at Island Park in Fargo. And it's Saturday through Monday. That is this weekend, Monday. Join the Silver Follies for their annual spring showcase on the Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater stage. It's directed by Bill Lucas, and this year's Follies performance takes on the theme Music and Mayhem. The program will include lively musical numbers, dance, and a short scripted play within a play. It's a whodunit entitled A Murdered Mystery. Now, the Silver Follies features performers aged 50-plus, you know, demonstrating that performing is not only for the young, but also the young at heart. 7:30 p.m. in the evening and 2 p.m. on Sunday. Runs from $5 to $10 for a ticket. Again, that runs Saturday through Monday at the stage at Island Park.
There's going to be a roaring good time at the Great Gatsby Saturday the 19th in Minot at the Ward County Historical Society. They are hosting a Great Gatsby-themed event that corresponds to the opener of the Pioneer Village Historical Museum. So this event is on Saturday the 19th from noon to 5. So you're going to play sort of Great Gatsby-themed games like croquet and badminton and big garden chess and checkers. I'm sure Daisy and Tom and all of them would play these games. The event, noon to 5, and it's free. Again, this is in Minot at the Ward County Historical Society.
A big band concert Sunday in Bismarck at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum. You can join the Bisman Big Band for a free concert at 2 o'clock on May 20th at the State Museum. Consisting of some of the region's finest musicians and music educators, the Bisman Big Band performs in a variety of styles, including swing, Latin, rock, contemporary, and timeless jazz and big band favorites, including the music of Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Maynard Ferguson, Stan Kenton, and more. 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon at the North Dakota Heritage Center, and it's free.
The 12th Annual Artsy this Friday, the 18th in Grand Forks at the North Dakota Museum of Art. This is hosted by the Greater Grand Forks Young Professionals. And this is showcasing both up-and-coming and distinguished artists. And you have the opportunity to look at art in a lot of different mediums and mingle with the talented local and regional artists. And, of course, support them by purchasing some of that art. 5 to 8 p.m. on Friday in Grand Forks at the North Dakota Museum of Art, which is on the campus of the University of North Dakota. And it's free, unless, of course, you want to buy some art.
Yeah. Central Dakota Children's Choir, Leaving Our Musical Footprint. That's Friday and Saturday in Bismarck at the Bell Mayhos Auditorium. The concerts will feature performances by each of CDCC's five choirs, with a special performance by a pre-choir singing for second graders during Saturday's concert. To date, the choirs have performed for more than 130,000 people in the tri-state area. They've been invited to perform at many local, state, and regional events. So take in the Central Dakota Children's Choir Friday and Saturday at the Bell Mayhus Auditorium. It's 7:30 in the evening, and the cost for tickets, $10 to $13.
All right, my pick of the week is that there is a big running thing coming up.
Oh.
Yes, the Fargo Marathon actually already started. They have different sort of runs for pets, or you can get out there on your bicycle. They've got a 10K, a 5K, a half marathon, a full marathon. And if you are not running it, go out and support those runners. It actually does make a big difference to see people out along that route. Go to the Fargo Marathon website. You can download all of the different course maps and just pick a spot and cheer some runners on.
It's a really big deal. It's a lot of fun for runners and spectators.
Keep in mind a lot of street closures, though. So
yeah.
Walk or bike if you can.
Look for the map. Okay. Mine is the NDSU Chamber Music Festival. It's Sunday and Wednesday in Fargo at a couple of venues. Sunday at NDSU's Beckwith Recital Hall, Wednesday at the Plains Art Museum, then back to the Beckwith. Area classic music fans will hear violinist Elizabeth York and cellist Alice Yu and mezzo-soprano Clara Osowski and many members of the FM Symphony. It will be 2 o'clock and 7:30 on Sunday at the Beckwith on NDSU campus. Then there's a noon concert Wednesday at the Plains Art Museum, followed by a final concert Wednesday evening at 7:30 back at Beckwith. It's free and open to the public, and that's what's happening.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 17th. North Dakota remembers World War I. On this date in 1918, the Great War was raging, and North Dakota boys were fighting in the frontline trenches. The first 3 years of the war had shown that when modern weapons for conducting warfare met older tactics, the losses were staggering. Germany was beginning a new spring offensive. But for one North Dakotan, his overseas duty was a more exotic adventure. Tucked away in a little-mentioned corner of the war, Lieutenant W.T. Hyatt had been experiencing Eastern cultures. Hyatt was a former dispatcher with the Great Northern Railroad at Minot, who was recruited as an engineer for the American Railroad Commission. This commission had been sent to Eastern Russia, assigned with the task of organizing and improving the Russian railroad system. They traveled first to Honolulu, studying the Russian language on the way, and then journeyed to Vladivostok. Due to the Russian Revolution, they were turned away, instead making their way to Nagasaki. The Japanese were allies with the United States and Britain. At the beginning of the war, Japan had driven Germany from Shandong Province in China, and then allied with the Allies in hopes of obtaining more German-held territory, as well as a part of the Chinese mainland. As guests of the Japanese government, the Americans in Nagasaki were treated to theater presentations, banquets, and social gatherings. In late February, Lieutenant Hyatt again returned to the mainland, arriving first in Korea, and then on to Changchun, Manchuria. Approximately 220 members of the American Railroad Commission were allowed to enter Manchuria to help improve the portion of the Trans-Siberian Railway not held by the Bolsheviks. Chinese laborers were used on the railroad and also shipped to the European battlefields to dig trenches and perform other war-related jobs amid less than ideal conditions. Hyatt assisted on a train containing 15 boxcars, 18 feet long, each containing approximately 100 Chinese men, women, and children destined for the war gardens in Siberia. By the end of the war, Lieutenant William T. Hyatt and F.W. Strange, also from Minot, along with other members of the American Railroad Commission, had been successful in implementing significant changes on the railroad system, thereby improving the transportation of men and supplies to the front. After a successful tour in Manchuria, W.T. Hyatt returned home, where, among other things, he played trombone in the Minot Community Band. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
China and the United States are holding trade talks. Among those keeping a close eye on the talks, everyone from auto parts makers in Michigan to winemakers in Napa Valley.
If you look at other wines from around the world, New Zealand, Australia, Chile, they either have zero tariffs or are going to zero tariffs next year as it relates to China. We're going up.
How tariffs affect American businesses. That's on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, it's time for our annual Summer Movies Preview. Ashley Thornburg will host, our in-house movie critic Matt O'Lean, and special guests Brittany Goodman and Tony Tilton. And news director Dave Thompson will be here for his weekly discussion of the news headlines. Join us for Main Street Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.